reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 14, The Forest of Enjoyment. This morning is text number 14. Yada tu parabhadaya andha atmane na upanamati tada ki pitriputra bahirshmatah pitriputra vasah talu bakshayati. I never know about the rhythm of these prose texts here. I know the traditional Brahmins have way, but anyway, I'll try. Yada tu parabhadayantha
Yada tu parabhadayantha
Atmane no panamati tadahi pitriputra bahishmatah
Atmane no panamati tadahi pitriputra bahishmatah
Pitriputran vasakalu bakshayati
Pitriputran vasakalu bakshayati
Yada tu parabhadayantha atmane
Yada tu parabhadayantha atmane
No panamati tadahi pitriputra bahishmatah
No panamati tadahi pitriputra bahishmatah
Pitriputran vasa khalu bhakshayati
Pitriputran vasa khalu bhakshayati
Yada tu parabhadayantha atmane
Yada tu parabhadayantha atmane
No panamati tadahi pitriputra bahishmatah
No panamati tadahi pitriputra bahishmatah
Pitriputran vasa khalu bhakshayati
Pitriputran vasa khalu bhakshayati Yeah.
When?
To.
But.
But.
Because of misfortune.
Because of misfortune.
Parabandaya.
Parabandaya.
In spite of exploiting all others.
In spite of exploiting all others.
Andaha.
Andaha.
Blind.
Blind.
Atmane.
Atmane.
For himself.
For himself.
Na upanamati.
Na upanamati.
Does not fall into one share. Tada, at
that time,
he certainly, the Triputra, of the fathers or sons, Bahishmatah, as insignificant as a piece of grass,
the
Triputra,
father or sons,
Va,
or
Saha,
he,
the conditioned soul,
Halu,
indeed,
Bhakshayati,
gives trouble to. Translation. In this material world, when the conditioned soul cannot arrange for his own maintenance, despite exploiting others, he tries to exploit his own father or son, taking away that relative's possessions, although they may be very insignificant. He cannot acquire things from his father, son, or other relatives. He is prepared to give them all kinds of trouble. Srila Prabhupada's report. Once, we actually saw a distressed man steal ornaments from his daughter just to maintain himself. As the English proverb goes, necessity knows no law. When a conditioned soul needs something, he forgets his relationship with his relatives and exploits his own father or son. We also receive information from Srimad Bhagavatam that in this age of Kali, the time is quickly approaching when a relative will kill another relative for a small farthing. Without Krishna consciousness, people will deteriorate further and further into a hellish condition wherein they will perform abominable acts. I'll read the translation again. In this material world, when the conditioned soul cannot arrange for his own maintenance, despite exploiting others, he tries to exploit his own father or son, taking away that relative's possessions, although they may be very insignificant. He cannot acquire things from his father, son, or other relatives. He is prepared to give them all kinds of trouble. I guess this is going to be a horrors of the material world class. Well, there's plenty of that. We should know about it and not forget it, because Bhagavatam is pointing out to us these features of the material world, because we tend to get very sentimental about the material world when we try to enjoy it. We think that it's a nice place and everything can be wonderful and everyone's happy. And so here it's pointing out what we've seen, that when one finally becomes strapped for money, somehow or other doesn't get what he wants from others, then even that person will turn to his own relatives and try to exploit or defraud them in different ways to get what he wants. It says here, even if one's father or son doesn't have much, he just has some straw, still you go for it. And if you can't get it, then you just give them all kinds of trouble anyway. You sue them. You hire lawyers. You take them to court. This is happening, of course. Children are now taking their parents to court. Well, all the time for money reasons. They sue them. Also, sometimes they take them to court just because you didn't bring me up well. That's also happening. And it goes the other way around. We already see that when a person becomes greedy or ambitious, they behave, well, just like, for example, King Kamsa, when he wanted to take over a kingdom, then the ties of family affections did not at all stop him. This is always the history of kings, actually, royal families. They tend to slaughter each other quite freely. Kamsa's typical of this. Later on in India, there's the famous story of Aurangzeb. There was a very great emperor of Hindustan named Shahjahan. He built the Taj Mahal. No, that wasn't him.
Shahjahan
built. And he had a bunch of sons. So Shahjahan got sick, and his sons, in anticipating to his early death, each declared themselves the king of Hindustan, all of them, and began to fight among themselves. And Aurangzeb, one of his sons, became more powerful, took his father, put him in jail, killed off all his brothers. The father had to sit in jail while all this was going down, while his own son was just killing off his brothers and imprisoned his father and so on. So this is the kind of thing that happens. Also, we see a little while ago there was a famous case in Beverly Hills. This is an interesting case where there was a very well-to-do family. I said that in Beverly Hills, California, so they had quite a bit of money. The father was a man in his mid-40s who was originally an immigrant to this country from Cuba, I believe, and had worked very, very hard and had bettered himself and become very rich. He was in the music and entertainment business. He was in the music and slugged by his waist. I think he got it on a cool. How's that?
Maybe we have to do something real unusual.
I'm going to tell my horror stories here.
It's not okay, it's going to hold.
You won't stay there, huh?
No.
So you want to rest that on the drum head?
That's what I was thinking of doing.
Well, why don't you put the drum right here?
Right here.
That good enough?
I don't think it's private.
That's fine. Leave it. Doesn't matter. Okay. So anyway, the fellow worked his way up. He had two teenage sons, Beverly Hill High School, and things like that. He was worth a lot of money and worth a lot more dead than alive because of insurance. One night there was a frantic phone call to the police from the sons, and they come home and found both of their parents sitting in front of the television eating popcorn and had been brutally murdered at very close range. Shotguns had been fired into their faces, you know, so the bodies were smeared all over the walls. And so the police came, and there was an investigation. And after some time, finally, the two sons were arrested for the murder. They had done it. Now, it took a while to get the evidence together, but actually the shocking thing was is that the police knew immediately that it was the sons, because the Beverly Hills police chief says, oh, whenever you see the parents, both husband and wife, killed together, it's usually the children, he says. Because people were thinking, well, maybe it was a mob hit because the guy was in the entertainment industry, and maybe gangsters, he had gotten mixed up with them. But gangsters don't kill both the husband and wife, usually. When they say so, when it's both, they said they're almost certain it's the children. So he spoke from experience. So these kinds of things are... They wanted them, you know, they didn't want to wait. They wanted what they wanted. As soon as the parents were dead, they went out, bought cars, you know, and all kinds of things. He was a son, a father who had, you know, done everything to give his sons everything, and they went away in very close range, just slaughtered them. So these are the kind of things that we see are happening. Because he says here, without Krishna consciousness, people will deteriorate further and further into a hellish condition, wherein they will perform abominable acts. So the point is that there are always so many different plans afoot to improve things. The government are always declaring wars on crime, wars on this, wars on that. And they fail again and again and again. There was only a very brief period of euphoria when the Cold War was over and the Berlin Wall went down, where everybody thought, oh, now there's going to be an age of peace. And then very quickly, everyone turned on each other and started slaughtering each other right now. The whole world sits around while ancient blood feuds are going on, and genocides going on in former Yugoslavia. And everybody's standing by wringing their hands in great distress, and nobody can seem to stop it. There is not any possibility of material conditions being alleviated unless you really go to the root of the problem. People get into various ways to solve the problems of mankind. But the people who solve the problems have themselves the same diseases they're trying to cure. There's the famous allegory Animal Farm by the English author George Orwell. It was an allegory about communism. And it takes place on a farm, and there's a revolt of the animals against the farmers. The animals understand they're being exploited and abused and mistreated by the farmers. So among the animals, the pigs are the most intelligent. The pigs organize the other animals and they had a revolution, and they deposed the farmers and take over the farm. And now, and their slogan was, all animals are equal, under that banner that all animals are equal. As soon as the farm is taken over, well, somebody has to still be in charge, so the pigs, naturally, the leaders of the revolution, they run the farm. And then the slogan changes, starts to change. One says, all animals are equal, and then the banner has a modification, but some are more equal than others. And so the story ends with the pigs now living in the farmer's house and sitting at his table, and the animals are peeking in the blinds, and they see a feast is going on. And the pigs have invited the farmers are back there, and the pigs and the farmers are sitting at the table feasting and laughing and joking. And they said you couldn't tell the pigs from the farmers or the farmers from the pigs. This is what happens. All these big causes get to be betrayed because nobody really is radical enough. The English word radical comes from a Latin word, radix, which means root. So to do something radical means to go to the root of the problem. And none of these different solutions, with all what Prabhupada says, the planning commissions and the intellectuals sitting around in their think tanks trying to solve the miseries of human life, it just doesn't work. And human history has been going on, and if anyone looks at human history, it's just one series of miseries being replaced by another series of miseries, and people coming up with various idealistic schemes to solve the problems, and the solutions simply become the new problems for human life. So that's because they haven't dealt with the fundamental problem of that lies in the root of human relationships. And that fundamental problem is the tendency of the living entity to want to lord it over others, to be the enjoyer and to be the controller. This tendency is there in the heart of all living beings. And when they come to the human form of life, they exercise that tendency in various ways. And it has been taught at one time that people are good, but the social system is bad. But if we change the social system, then it'll produce good people without this exploitative tendency. But it hasn't worked that way. That tendency is still there. Because it's not that human beings are bad exactly, but this desire to lord it over, to control, to exploit, which poisons every relationship that human beings enter into, not only with each other and among each other, on the level of individuals, on the level of family, on the level of community, on the level of nations, among human beings, but also relationship between human beings and other species, relationship between human beings and the environment. Everything is spoiled by this mentality of being the enjoyer and being the controller. Where does that mentality come from? Where does it arise, and how is it removed? Now, of course, what some people try to do when they become disgusted by this tendency and therefore want to get away from it and enter into spiritual life is they have the idea of spiritual life as removal of oneself from all circumstances and relationships where this tendency can occur. Cloister yourself away. Don't involve anything. Radically reduce your possessions. Try to live poor, and so on. But it seemed that even in these circumstances, if people can't lord it over big things, then they'll lord it over little things. And literature is full of stories of monks and nuns and priests and convents who have major wars over 3 square feet of space, because the status is there, which in those minds at 3 square feet will assume in the confined quarters of a religious institute the same sort of status that, say, a whole kingdom would be in the outside world, so that the false ego still gets invested. The false ego may not be destroyed so easily. So this business of just withdrawing from temptation, getting yourself off into a situation away from worldly people, well, you tend to bring it with you anyway, as much as you can. As much as, maybe not as much as you can, but anyway, it's there. It comes with the territory. Many cases, this of course is this is a kind of process of negation. One thinks that really the idea is to obliterate my individuality or my personality. Just like in the West we say, in America we say, oh, he's on an ego trip. So that ego itself, ego means individual identity, ego itself is identified with being self-centered, lording it over. And so the idea is to become egoless, which means absolutely devoid of any personal identity. So this is an effort of what Prabhupada calls spiritual suicide. It's my individuality, it's my personality that makes me an exploiter. The whole thing is poisoned. And really what I have to do is enter into the situation of complete withdrawal, where I have no individuality and no relationships. As soon as there's a relationship, there's exploitation. So the transcendent position is a position in which there are no relationships. That's what they long for. Some view the situation, the transcendental situation, as free from exploitation, lording it over, ego, because it's absolutely devoid of everything whatsoever. That's like a doctor curing the disease by killing the patient. Well, he's not suffering anymore. So this is one attempt at a solution. And again, it doesn't work. It's highly artificial. And when one just withdraws in this way, go to retreats, then as soon as there's the slightest effort to engage in any activity or relationships, immediately the contamination is there again. So the real problem is, of course, that it is not the relationships of that, is that for the living entities in the material world, relationships have become poisoned at the very source. And the very source is they become poisoned in the individual's relationship with Krishna. The Prabhupada uses the phrase original sin. He says, which is of course we're familiar with Christianity, and so Prabhupada, I'm sure, could have picked it up from there. He went to a Presbyterian college. Scotch Presbyterian College, where they're very big on original sin. But he said the original sin, the original sinful will, he used the term that way. I think this is in Ishvarupanishad. The original sinful will of the living entity is the desire to become the Lord. The desire to become the Lord. The original sinful will of the living entity. According to the Christian version of original sin, as the old New England Primer put it, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. So there's a story, there was the original human being. His name was Adam. I understand Adam means just human, a man. There was original human Adam, and his consort Eve, and they disobeyed the order of God. They wanted to be like God. It says that God had put a tree in the garden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and said, don't eat it. If they eat of this tree, they'll become just like me, so don't touch this forbidden fruit. Everything else you can eat, but not this. They were tempted by the snake. They disobeyed God, ate the fruit, were expelled from paradise, and ever since then, people have had to eat their bread in the sweat of their brow, work hard, suffer, and so on. So all suffering is a fall. All creation fell, they say, when this happened. That's the story. So our primordial, according to this story, our primordial, original ancestor of all humanity, Adam and Eve, sinned against God, and all subsequent generations have inherited this sin like a kind of genetic disease. That's the basic story, original sin. I hope I got it right. But it wasn't our sin. It was our ancestor's sin, and somehow or other we've gotten it. It's like somebody finds they've got Tay-Sachs syndrome or one of those kinds of inherited genetic defects cause a disease. They didn't do anything to deserve it, but they've got it. Well, according to the Vedic version, Prabhupada gives us, every living entity himself chooses not to surrender to Krishna. It's our choice. Somehow or other we have the choice, and somehow or other we engage in what Prabhupada describes as the misuse of freedom. Of course we don't have the choice, really, not to be controlled by Krishna, but we're given the choice of voluntary service, and we turn it down. So the Bhagavad Gita says, Icha dvesha samutena dvanda mohena bharata. That the living entities come into this world covered by the dualities of desire and hate. Icha and dvesha. Prabhupada comments on this verse in Srimad Bhagavatam somewhere. I can't remember where it was. Been looking for it actually, where I read it. No, I have folios, I can't find anything. But somewhere in Bhagavatam, Prabhupada mentions this verse, and he says, first of all, let me go back for a minute. You can see that this desire and hate is very, the duality of desire and hate is very basic. Not only in human beings, but it's a condition of being a living organism. I had one time a class in biology or psychology or something, and the teacher drew an oval on the board to represent an organism, and within that oval drew an arrow pointing this way and an arrow pointing that way. And I labeled the arrows approach and avoidance. And this is like the basic vectors of a living entity's behavior. Approach, to get those things that satisfy the needs of the living entity, that is to say, desire. And avoidance, to go away from the things that will inhibit the satisfactions of a living entity or hurt it. So hate. And there it is, the basic push and pull of all organisms. Icha and dvesha. So Krishna says, you see that everywhere, desire and hate. and the living entity, everyone is being run by this. Let me gratify my senses, and let me avoid or destroy or get away from whatever's going to stop or harm the gratification of my senses. So that's the basic fundamental conditioning of the living entity. And of course, from that desire and hate, everything else develops, all these problems. So in discussing this verse in Bhagavatam, Icha Dvesha Samutena Dvanda Mohena Bharata, Prabhupada says that the original desire and hate of the living entity, that is to say the conditioned soul, is directed toward Krishna. His original desire is, why can't I be God? That's the Icha. Why can't I be God? This is why the living entity is in the material world and not in the spiritual world. Because the desire is, the original desire is, why can't I be God? And therefore, what's the original hate? Why should Krishna be God? So that's the original difficulty that has put us into this awkward position in the material world. Now Prabhupada explains in the beginning of Nature, Nectar of Devotion, that we have a desire to love, and our desire to love wants to expand endlessly. And because we are here in the material world, we are reposing that desire to love on entities in the material world. And therefore, that desire to love becomes baffled, becomes stopped. It cannot expand very far. It never becomes completely satisfied because there's no adequate object for our desire to love in this material world. But he says that when we love Krishna, we turn our love to Krishna, then automatically that love becomes distributed to everyone and to everything. So when we love Krishna, it's not exclusive. It may seem like that. It seems a little cruel when someone's becoming a devotee of Krishna and that person is refocusing his love toward Krishna. Relatives will protest, "Oh, don't you love us anymore? You're taking the love that you've been giving us to us and reposing it on that or it or him or something like that. It's cruel, it's unnatural," and so on. They would complain like this. That there's some kind of narrowing of focus of attention. That's unnatural. And it may seem like that in the beginning, because we're instructed that we have learned to love substitutes for Krishna. Now we're returning our love to the original thing. But because Krishna is not one thing or one entity among many, he is the absolute truth and contains with himself everything else and everyone else. So actually, when that love is correctly reposed on the original entity, on the prime entity, on the absolute truth, Krishna, it does in fact become universal. And the example is given of pouring water on the root of a tree or giving food to the stomach. So when that love is returned to Krishna and our relationship is given to Krishna, love is given to Krishna, that relationship is rectified, then automatically all the other relationships will become rectified in due course of time. And the love that is given to Krishna will expand and flow to all of the living beings without any loss of intensity. Because you'll see that what happens is, of course, people realize what a thing is, people try to get rid of their selfishness. There's a person that loves only himself. In fact, he's so selfish he doesn't even bring his paycheck home for his own wife and family. By the time he gets home, he goes home, he cashes the check at the bar and drinks most of it. He doesn't get home. So we praise that person that actually brings the paycheck home. We think it's the height of unselfishness that he actually gives money and takes care of his family. That's a big thing, at least in America, to actually elevate people to the point where they take care of their own relatives. Because we're at this stage, as mentioned here, where many people can't even care that much about their own relatives. They have wives, children, husbands, but they don't care. But still, people then they'll love their families. And then we see get them in these horrible and invidious relationships with anyone who's not their family. Feuds, lawsuits, neighbors, you know, pouring garbage over each other's fences and letting dogs loose on each other and calling the pizza deliveries and diaper services to get back. Huge, gigantic feuds, and just among. So then one tries to come to a higher level and have some community spirit where there's a sense of oneness, you know. But all the residents, like in Philadelphia, Manayunk or Roxborough, they try to develop this little postage stamp of this is our community and develop a community spirit. And there's some that can rise even to this higher position. And so on, people try to rise to greater, and then they become a person who works for the good of their nation or their people, like Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi. This is now the realm of sainthood, practically. You sacrifice your people, your own family, to work for the good of your people, your race, your ethnic group, your nation. So then you're considered, you know, a Mahatma. But still, your ethnic group hates the next ethnic group. Your race hates the other race. Because there's still selfishness. It's still. So people say, no, we have to love all humanity. They want to become humanitarians and break down those boundaries. And so they go on and try to become more and more universal in their different ways. But what happens, of course, the more you try to love humanity, and what you find out is that people that tend to love humanity in the abstract have very little use for human beings in the concrete. They don't like individual people. They only like humanity as long as it's at a distance and in large masses. But their own personal relationship they have a very difficult time with. And so actually, the more one's love gets more abstract or diffuse, it also loses in intensity. So there's always a conflict between being particular and being universal. But that conflict is resolved when we come to the point of Krishna, who is simultaneously the universal person and a particular individual person at one and the same time. That's why he's unique and is the adequate object of our love. So just as when we love Krishna, automatically all of the living entities are included in that love. What happens when we hate Krishna? When we desire his position and envy him having that position. When we hate Krishna, that same hate spills out to everyone and everything. It's mentioned about the demons that they become envious of the super soul who lives in their own bodies and in the bodies of others. Someone who hates Krishna, who is envious of Krishna, is actually envious of everything and everyone and even of his own self. That's how deep the disease is. So when that all relationships are poisoned like that, then everything is going to go amiss, no matter what kind of projects you try to take care of. So that's why we see that these perpetual records of failures to straighten things out to solve this problem or to solve that problem. They cannot go away. Unless we solve the original problem, the problems can't go away unless we solve the original problem. Now, as soon as you say this to modern politicians, they say, oh, that's religion, as though it's no business of the state. It's the business of the state to solve the problem. Doesn't the state want to solve, you know, the drug problem, for example? How will they actually solve the crack problem? I tell you what their plan is to solve the crack problem. Wait 10 years or 20 years and everybody who's into it is dead. That's how they're going to solve the problem. They can't stop it. That's how they solve most problems. Make a lot of rhetoric and pretend they're doing something. They commit and then wait till it goes away. That's how doctors solve most diseases too. Just wait and it goes away. Or it doesn't. One or the other. Anyway, they can't handle these problems. And the real reason they can't handle them is they cannot go to the actual source. And as soon as we point out what the source is, they say, oh, that's religion, that's not our business. It is your business. If your business is to see to the welfare of the citizens, then you want to really solve their problems. You have to go to this. And of course, what we deny is that it's a business of religion. We're talking about Krishna, we're talking about the facts, we're talking about science, we're talking about what is the actual truth of things. So why have we put it in this category called religion? So that's a misfortune. That they actually prevent themselves from coming to the actual solution. Because this, unfortunately, as soon as we come to the solution, we can't accept it because it's religion. This means the people themselves have poisoned their relationship with Krishna, and therefore, at the very beginning, eliminated that solution to the problem, which will be their misfortune. So, in the forest of enjoyment, things will just keep getting worse and worse and worse and worse, until we can actually, by Krishna's grace, try to turn things around and bring people back to what they originally to the position that we originally have to restore ourselves to, that is the position of being devotees of Krishna. Any questions, comments?
We see sometimes that amongst those who are trying to overcome Isha and Grisha, devotees, in our society, that there's still conflicts amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but not even so much concentrating that, but also we see that when one takes up devotional service, it's not exactly that their character as a person changes, it seems, mm-hmm. so much. They tend to be a very strong, heavy person.
Yeah, they'll still be strong and heavy, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. So, taking that into consideration, how effective even amongst devotees will be?
What we've seen is that many, many more people are attracted to the principles of Krishna consciousness than are actually able to follow them. And if there seems to be a discouraging lack of results in Krishna consciousness, of the dissolution of false ego, of people working for the welfare of others and so on, devotees fighting among themselves, it's part of it's due to simply lack of proper application. People want to come to Krishna consciousness, they're attracted to it. I recently got a letter from an old godbrother of mine who was very upset with the Krishna consciousness movement and the way it's going, and spent some pages telling me how much he loves Prabhupada. And then spent some time also telling me how, in spite of the fact that he never was able to follow the regular principles very well, he's still dedicated to Prabhupada. But I just have to say, I don't accept that. Because why don't I accept it? Because I heard Prabhupada himself say, if you love Krishna, you will follow his orders. Otherwise, where's the proof that you love Krishna? That's the problem. Where's the proof? Where's the proof that you love Krishna? See, people can say, I love Krishna, I love Krishna. Just like in India, so many people say, I love Krishna. They stand in front of the deities and real tears flow from their eyes. But the proof that they love Krishna is you follow his order. And Prabhupada asks for proof. So similarly, the proof that we love Prabhupada, or we love our spiritual master, we follow his order. So I have to say about my old godbrother that he's on a platform I would consider sentimental. And he's very disappointed. Well, the letter's about how he's disappointed in the Hare Krishna movement. But actually, his disappointment resides in himself, which he doesn't really want to deal with as much as he would like to deal with everybody else. Somehow it's everybody else's fault. He has not developed love of God. Well, enough people hasn't. So, what we have to do, if that's the case, we have to again look and see what is our real business. If you look at Prabhupada's letters over and over again, he says, if we simply stick to our principles, we follow our regular principles, we chant our rounds, then everything will go well. And if we do not, the whole thing will become a farce. But I don't see any way around it. I don't see any way around it. So that's what we have to focus our intelligence and our effort on, and do all those things necessary we have to do in order to follow the regulative principles of Krishna. But we know what to do. Now we have to seriously take it up. Then the world will be changed. Otherwise, we'll simply have one other religion where people are going around mouthing high principles while their practices are something else again. Prabhupada didn't come to this. You know, the Church of England is there. All these churches are already well established for that kind of thing. So that's one thing. It's just simply the application has not been what it ought to be. And also, another thing, we may have to be a little patient. It may take people time. After all, look where people were coming from. Look at their former habits. It may take some time. Prabhupada came and he said Krishna consciousness is easy. Well, saying easy to a bunch of Americans may be it's easier than Raja Yoga, but it may not be as easy as ordering a pizza from Domino's. You know, what is our idea of easy? It's maybe real fast food religion. So it's not quite like that. It is easy. But still, for us, we may find it more difficult than we first thought. So let's keep trying, and let's be patient. And in course of time, I'm absolutely convinced, if we do what Srila Prabhupada has told us to do, then I've seen enough results myself to not be discouraged. After all, when people begin to say to Prabhupada, oh, so many people have left, isn't that discouraging? Prabhupada said, what's encouraging is that some have stayed. So, you can look at that one way or you can look at it the other way. We don't accept people's personalities to change. And sometimes persons can be very advanced devotees and still have they won't be immoral, but they may still have some character traits carried over from their previous existence. We read this in our literature, and in that case we're not supposed to notice those things, because they're fully engaged in Krishna service. And a person who's fully engaged in Krishna service, actually all their actions will be merciful to other living beings, even though they may be sometimes brusque, abrupt, whatever else, and they grate on us. That's another thing.
Okay. Sometimes also people argue this way. Those devotees there, 15 years, 20 years, or 10 years, start in the progress moment. And somehow or other they cannot adjust with their own God brothers. Or they have some faults, they lack. So they are saying this way, but if the devotees, those are inside, they are following. Because we are left the moment, we don't want to make any offense on our devotees. We cannot tolerate, that's fine. Lord is also, instruction is there, Srila Prabhupada's instruction there. We have our books, we are practicing every day. So we care about this temple. You people already have 20 years temple, no reason. You see only two years maybe, 3 years we can do so many things.
Mm-hmm.
How to convince him this temple?
Well, the temples that ISKCON has are Prabhupada's temples. It was Prabhupada who went and installed deities everywhere. It was Prabhupada who started this institution, who Prabhupada was very proud to say, we have temples here, 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 here. He made these temples not just for the devotees, but out of magnanimity of heart, that here's a place where a public can come, here's a place where people can get prasadam, here's a place where preaching can go on, here's a place where people can be trained. So this is, it may be difficult, it's much difficult, it's difficult, much, sure, temple life can be difficult, communal life is difficult, people living together, especially in a temple, we're bringing in new people all the time. So it's very difficult because new people come in, they have so many problems, difficulties, and sometimes for the sake of service, they'll tolerate so much. Somebody you wouldn't have in your house for 10 minutes, but still, because they'll serve Krishna, that one thing is there, they'll serve Krishna. Then we let them stay. So certainly it's an austerity to live in a temple and work in a temple. But it's magnanimous. It's adharya, you know, it's an old, it's inviting everybody. And this is what Prabhupada did. So otherwise, they're his. You know, these deities here were installed by Srila Prabhupada, not by me. He rode on Fifth Avenue with these Jagannath deities. He came up here to take darshan of Nitai Gosundar in 1976. Where are these deities, he said. This is his temple. He sat here. So he's my spiritual master. This is his temple. He sacrificed, you know, so many years of his life for this ISKCON movement. He worked very, very hard. He could have been staying in Vrindavan in complete ecstasy. But he suffered like, he said, you know, to make, this is Prabhupada's own statement, he said, to make one devotee I have to shed my blood 50 gallons. That's what he said. I have to shed my blood 50 gallons to make one devotee. And he shed it. So what do I owe him? Because I'm here because he shed his blood. This is what he made. This is what he did. He's told us, at least, his last instructions, at least maintain what I have given you. I have no choice. I have no choice. So that's the best thing to do. I think that will be very pleasing to Srila Prabhupada. That we keep this institution going. He worked so hard, he did so much. And actually, he'll be judged by ISKCON. People say, what has Srila Prabhupada done? His name, ISKCON is there, his name is attached to it, and he will be judged by how ISKCON turns out. So, we have to protect the honor of Srila Prabhupada. Unfortunately, people are going to judge him by us, like it or not. They'll say, oh, what has he done? You know, you're his representative. You know that word, representative? You represent self. So we should all do everything we can to be worthy of Srila Prabhupada. Now we have 1996 is coming up, where we're going to focus everyone's attention that here's Srila Prabhupada's 100th anniversary. We won't have another chance like that for another 100 years to do something like that. You can see what the Ramakrishna mission is doing, you know, with that 100 years of Vivekananda coming, you know. So centenary is a big thing. However, we can focus everybody's attention on Srila Prabhupada, but the first thing we want to be able to show them is, see, this is his institution. That's what they'll look at. And so that's an opportunity to glorify Srila Prabhupada by making sure all his temples that he established, all the deities he installed. He begged their forgiveness when he installed the deities in Australia. Now I'm leaving you with much
job.
They don't know anything. We're hearing a tape of one lady who was a pujari there. They had Radha Krishna deities. They didn't know how to dress. They put a bonnet on Radharani, you know, like that. People didn't know. But still, Prabhupada invited these deities, come here, and begged them not to mind the way they were treated until everybody was properly trained. So we have to show that we are worthy of everything he's given us. I think it's late. Thank you very much.
Thank you.